class, open your heart and learn how to love.
I met Swami Kriyananda, and Jean, others are used to this, but I have to talk about him a lot because he is, to me, he exemplifies all the qualities that we're trying to accomplish, and from him I have learned what's possible, and he's a very good example. And I've known him well since 1969 when I first met him, and I've had many years of close friendship. When I first met him in 1969 and heard him speak for the first time, I was already looking for it. I was already on the spiritual path, and I was just looking for a way to make it more profound. It was all these incredible ideas that were just whizzing around in my head, but I didn't really get how to put them together. I also was at a certain stage of my life where I'd already sort of been and dropped out of college, and just I sort of didn't know where I knew that I wanted something that was profoundly true, and I knew that I was looking for something that would make me happy. I just had this desire to be happy, which of course everyone has, but I knew that I was different in it, in that I wasn't going to just do other things hoping they would make me happy. I had to see that the course I was on was really going to produce happiness, or else I didn't want to go down it. I also have always had the blessing and the curse of a very intense mental self, you know, just always too much. I would have been a good lawyer. As my nephew said to me, he said he's a good lawyer too because he always finds the loophole. And I said, well, you know, we're the same, so we'll just keep finding the loopholes until one of us, you know, gets it straight. And I went to Stanford University only for 1 year because I sort of held out through high school figuring that when I got to Stanford, I would meet people who really, I didn't have the word in my mind, but the word was wisdom, who really knew how to live, who really had understood the secret of happiness, which was connected in my mind with being intelligent in the conventional academic school sort of way. And I got there, and very, very quickly, I recognized that these people didn't really know any more than I did, that they were faking it. Actually, it happened perhaps too personal, but very clear about it. My married English professor tried to start an affair with me, which was so shocking to me, not because I was such a prude, although I didn't have much experience at that point, but because he would be so stupid as to think that that would be a good idea, told me that this man was not qualified to be my teacher. That was just it. I mean, like, if you have a wife and children and you're still going to start an affair with me, then you don't know beans about anything that I want to know. And so it just totally turned me off. And by the time I left, I was just utterly disengaged. So then, shortly thereafter, I encountered the principles of self-realization. And the principles that struck me powerfully were that we are, our own life is the result of our own actions and attitudes. That there's a cause and effect relationship, although subtle and not always easily discernible, nonetheless, the way I heard it was, what you do today creates your tomorrow, and what today is the result of yesterday. And that was like the first time anybody ever told me that I could pick it up somewhere and have an effect on it. I also heard that that self-forgetfulness is the way to happiness, not self-abnegation, not putting yourself down and thinking of yourself as unworthy, but putting yourself aside in preference to thinking about a higher reality. And I thought, now that's a good clue. I really like that one too. And so I sort of got very engaged in this, but I still didn't know what it looked like, is the only way I can say it. And I still hadn't met anyone that I thought exemplified these principles. And in fact, a friend of mine then, who was a seeker with us, met Swami Kriyananda. He was teaching yoga in the Bay Area, which he did for those years. And she called me up, and I will always remember. She said, I have met a real teacher. You know, and that to me meant someone who had done more than just read about this, had integrated it into their lives. Kriyananda was 40 years old at that point, you know, younger than I am now. But still, he was an extraordinary man at that time. And I heard him speak. And because I was very intellectually oriented, I can't exactly articulate. I didn't have, like, you know, I didn't go into cosmic consciousness or anything like that. But he made a profound impression on me. I still can have in my mind the mental image of the first time I saw him, just sort of striding down this aisleway in his characteristic manner, as if he just possessed the whole room, but not in an offensive way, just with this sense of energy. What I realize now, just energy. And I remember when he spoke, it occurred to me that this is the most intelligent man I've ever heard speak. And to me, that was like jelly on the peanut butter sandwich. That was so terrific, because I like intelligent people. It's a preference of mine. I like intelligent conversation. I like wit. I like people who can put their words together. I've subsequently learned that it's a very trivial aspect of goodness and real worth, but it's something I like the color blue. And so Kriyananda had so many characteristics that I was really fond of right off the bat, plus some other not quite identifiable something that told me that this man was a real teacher. And over the years that I've known him, I still find him to be, without parallel, the most intelligent man I have ever known, in his ability to discern and articulate truth. And for years and years, I kept being just so conscious of his massive mind that I adored. And because I've strived to be that kind of person, I would sort of wonder, what is the secret of his intelligence? He reads a lot, you know, and various things. And one day, I had a very strong revelation about this. And I realized that the intelligence of his mind comes from the clarity of his heart. And that's where I want to bring this today. Interesting, his posture, his characteristic posture, is that actually the farthest forward part of his body is his chest. You know, many of us lead with our heads. You know, I kind of like try to push at the world with the frontal lobe of my brain, or with my mouth. You know, try to get my words out ahead of everything to make sure. But he has this posture of this uplifted energy where the energy of his heart hits the world first. It's very interesting. Some of us, you know, even are a little concave like that out of a constant instinctive desire to pull the heart back and even protect it with the shoulders, you know. And his very deliberate position like this is one of courage. Now, I then spent quite some time trying to understand this, and it's all written about in other philosophical ways, which I'll touch on a little bit. The metaphysics of this are exactly what I'm going to say. Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, made the simple statement that reason always follows feeling. That whatever you're predisposed to feel emotionally, your mind will support it. And sometimes it sounds like a too simple phrase, but when you really start watching human nature and start watching yourself, you realize how often, when we have an emotional commitment to something, we just rationalize in all sorts of ways. This is how you marry the wrong person. You know, this is how you with almost all the mistakes that we later look back on as mistakes in our lives, we'll realize that there was some emotional predisposition, and then the mind found all these reasons why it was the right thing to do. And only when the emotions of the situation have calmed down enough do we suddenly realize that the reasoning was not very smart. Very often, in our day and age, you know, couples will divorce in those kinds of moods. The feelings will just get all agitated, and then it seems like a good idea, and then 3 or 4 years later, you know, there you are with the kids divided between two houses, and you won't be able to remember why. It seems so important at the time to break up that marriage, because your feelings got so much in the way of just a calm appraisal of it. And that doesn't mean that the feeling is not fundamental to wisdom. It just means that if the feelings are off, the mind can't be trusted, right? And so, and also there's another part that the role that the heart plays in it, which is if the heart is afraid to know something, it will block the mind's capacity to perceive it. I mean, how often, typical examples are bad intimate relationships that people get into, where afterwards, you say, how could I not notice, for example, that he was an alcoholic? Why didn't I get a clue from the fact that he hasn't held a job in the last 12 years? you know, why didn't I think about the fact that, you know, three women told me that he hit them? Why didn't I hear that? Because the heart didn't want to. Or it was afraid to, in the sense that if I allow these facts to enter, then I'm not going to get what I want. You know, I want this relationship to be wonderful. I want this man to be the one, or this woman to be the one. I want my children to be, I had to deal not too long ago with a family situation in which in the course of the process of our school, sometimes it's at kindergarten or first grade that if there are real psychological issues or brain issues with children, often the parents are not quite aware of it until you get to kindergarten or first grade. Until then they can say he's a little rambunctious, he's a little spoiled, maybe I've indulged him too much. But often in kindergarten, first and second grade, parents will have to really face the fact that this child is not growing up normal, or it's going to require a whole special ed situation, whatever it might be. So on several occasions over the years of running our children's school here, we've been in what are very, you know, just very difficult situations where parents are having to come to a recognition that they probably knew, but they were pushing back all the time. That this, you know, I'm going to have to deal with this child differently. This is not going to be just what I thought it was going to be. And you just watch how feelings of the heart just make even highly intelligent people just blind, because they just don't want to know because of all that it means. It's a very extreme example, but a good one. And in little ways, all the time in our lives, we want things to be different than they are. We want them to be different, so we turn it a little bit to make it different. The whole illusion of Maya, which is the Sanskrit word for the fact that we look at this physical world and we think it's real, and we think it's really here, and even the scientists tell us that it's not really here, it's just energy, and all these different patterns, we don't want that to be true. I mean, on a very deep soul level, and we can't dissolve that delusion just with a snap of the fingers, but we don't want that to be true. We want there to be an external answer. We want there to be something out there that's going to make me happy. We're incarnations away from being ready to accept the fact of divine consciousness within ourselves. So we don't see it. Now, what I began to understand about Kriyananda, and it's been a profound teaching for me, is the fact that he has a commitment to what is true with a level of courage that I've never seen in anyone else. He just wants to know what's true. He's spiritually evolved sufficiently that even though he has at times when delusion captures him, his commitment to escape from every false reality into the one true reality is so profound that even if there's a little blip on the radar screen, he moves on from it. As a result, his mind has this clarity and power because it's not corrupted by the fear of the heart. And so I come to the word courage. He's just not afraid to know. He's not afraid to know that it was his fault. He's not afraid to know that it's your fault. He's not afraid to know that it's not going to work out. He's not afraid to recognize that it's going to work out beautifully. He's just not afraid. He wants what is to happen. I know one particular time in his life many years ago when he sort of committed himself to this whole direction in his life and for Ananda with a tremendous amount of fanfare, you know, national publicity, and he, you know, wrote all these brilliant treatises describing what was going to happen and blah, blah, blah. And in a matter of months, it just did not work out. I mean, just like a balloon being punctured, it just all came apart. And we were sitting in the living room of his house, and he was discussing the fact that he said, I'll never forget it, he said, if I chose to be, I could be quite embarrassed, he said. You know, because essentially I've made a fool of myself. He said, but I'll choose not to be. And that was just that. It's like, this is the truth. Why should I do anything to try to hide from it? Because this is what's happened. Now, that's the goal. You know, I've seen it exemplified. Some of you know him a little bit. I'm telling the story because it's a good example. That's the goal. Now, also understanding, using Kriyananda again as an example, that kind of courage makes you anything but cold. Sometimes we think that if the mind is stronger than the heart, and there's a lot of especially in our culture right now, which has become so left brain oriented. It's become very masculine in its orientation. Not I don't blame men. I don't think that that's what's happening, but it's become masculine. And because men tend to have a predominance of masculine energy, although nowadays you meet women who are more male than most men. You know, I was just reading about the women's soccer team, which has been so terrific for really making women's sports really first class. And you know how some of those girls, especially the older ones, just had to play men's sports because they were just way too male for the girls. So they had to play with the boys. And you know, one of them even played tackle football because she's in a woman's body, but she's got a completely male attitude and just needed the field of expression, which is traditionally male, because that was who she was. It doesn't mean that you're transgender or homosexual or anything. It just means that all of us are both. And most of the time, you're oriented more toward the body that you're in, but not always. And the goal is to become a perfect circle anyway. So it really makes no difference. You just need to get into balance with this. But because our culture, and these are reasons that have nothing to do with men or women. Men or women and the roles they play are the result of cosmic forces. It's not that human beings on this planet make the planet. It's that the energy is in place, and then all of us incarnate to play out the drama. But the drama has been that it's been a very yang-oriented, the yin-yang Chinese idea. Yang is the male. It's been a very yang culture. And because it's so leaning over so far to being yang, there's now this boomerang thing happening, but we're trying to make it more yin. And that, to my way of looking at it, is one of the reasons why so many women are pushing themselves in an unfeminine way, in a non-traditional feminine way. Many females are behaving with very male energy in the sense of pushing forward to intrude themselves into traditional male bastions to bring a balance. You know, we need women in politics and in medicine and in business, because it's all become so yang, it's just going to fall over. It needs to be more yin. Women, however, make a mistake if they try to out-male the males. You know, once they get into those positions, they need to follow why they're there, which is to be a balance, not to just make it worse. But because of that orientation, we have developed an appropriate, but a somewhat almost sentimental, sudden affection for the heart. You know, we need to be more heart, we need to listen to the heart, we need to do this with the heart, we need to do that with the heart. Well, if we really start doing too much of that, we're going to be just as mixed up as we've ever been. Because when the heart just runs around without being balanced by the reason, it's also quite a mess. And without specifically describing it that way, there's been a hint of that in what a few of you have said, which is we get too far out there with just this sort of yin accepting energy, and all of a sudden you're just, you know, you're creamed peas. You're just finished. It's over. You can't live. You can't live in one side or the other. You have to live in the perfect balance of both. And the absence of either one causes us pain. It's just as simple as that. We're caused pain. Now, pain is part of the game. And there is no way that we're going to get from here to there without going through some fire. It's a bad system. I certainly have never found a choice in it. And I'm touched by the fact that Paramahansa Yogananda himself says that he talked about a vision he had, a tussle he has with Divine Mother is how he described it. Divine Mother is the way he always talked about, the way he related to God, because the mother image is much more intimate. And so he said he argued with Divine Mother as to why her children, which is us, have to suffer so much to learn anything. And that Yogananda himself protested. And so I figure if he can object to it, we can too. But you can object a great deal to things. But if they can't be shifted, it's not the better part of wisdom to just keep objecting. Because I'm not a parent, but I have this boy staying with us. My nephew is staying with us for 6 weeks. And because he's a lawyer, even though he's just a 10-year-old boy, It's always interesting discussions, and he really loves to try to get his way by talking you into it, you know, and he'll just go on and on and on. And this morning we were having such a discussion, at which point, at a certain point, I finally said, you know, really, you have to just realize that at a certain point, David and I are going to make the decisions, and that's going to be that. Because, and he said, I know, because it's your responsibility, he said like that. And I remember my sister, who's a very good mother, a couple of years ago when he was just really having a fit about something, and he was trying to persuade her to do differently, she looked right at him and she said, have I ever changed my mind when I speak to you like this? And he just said, no, because she never, we know she's a good mom. Once she laid down the law, and she was careful before she did it, but once she did it, was it. He could do anything he wanted. It was not going to change. And of course, that's the right way to raise children, because that's it. And so it's all pointless. You may continue to suffer if you want to, but forget it. Nothing else is going to happen. And the images that we see in the world around us are given to us, just as I was saying to you, Jeffrey, about, you know, the passion and love that you feel for those who are close to you is a gift to give us a clue as to what our potential is. And in the whole way that human life is arranged is a picture of reality up to the highest levels. It never stops. It becomes more subtle and is not as easy to grasp and can't be pointed to in the same way that we can count our fingers. But it's no less objectively so. In the commentary on the Bhagavad Gita that Yogananda wrote, which is this great thick hundreds of page volume, the first several hundred pages are all these different lists. I mean, it's more than that, but it really feels like that. List after list of like a chart of how the universe is organized. And then on this plane of consciousness, there's the 21 thises. I mean, really, the 21 thises and the 32 thats and the 16 instruments of feeling and the 21 aspects of knowing. And I mean, it's all intuitive inner understanding, but it was all what just struck me about it was that it was also orderly, and that it was a direct continuation of the orderliness that biologists discover and physicists discover and musicians discover and cooks discover. I mean, everything has an order. It works in a certain way. And if you really want to do something, it's not just a question. And even if you want to invent something new, you have to invent it out of the patterns that are there. You can't just create new patterns. I mean, nowadays, people are trying to do that. I recall that Kriyananda and a group went to a concert, so-called. I put in quotes. I am no fan of modern music of almost any kind. There was this elderly gentleman who, at that time, was living at Ananda. He's since passed away. He was a very extremely cultured man, also very opinionated. And they listened to this modern concert, and it was just noise. I mean, it was just noise. Any objective person, like the emperor's new clothes, it was not pretty, and it was not pleasant, but it was modern. And they were having a discussion afterwards, and Hanel, this man, said, do you know, he said, music has three elements. He says, rhythm, harmony, and melody. He said, without rhythm, without harmony, and without melody, truly, it does not deserve to be called music. It was just sort of like saying, this emperor is not wearing any clothes. That's just the way it is. Now, people are determined that you can have music and without rhythm, harmony, and melody, but you don't have music, you have noise. And people might like it, but it's not music. It doesn't uplift the human spirit. It doesn't do all those things that music is designed to do. It can release tension. It can fill the space. But it's not music. But there's other more definite rules than that. You know, you have to put the oatmeal in the water in a certain way or else it makes lumps. It's just, you can't, it doesn't matter how much you want it to be different. One of my first teachers in my life was a sewing teacher, Mrs. Taylor, appropriately named, when I was about the age of my nephew. I was 9 and 10 years old. My mother never learned to sew, so she sent me off to these sewing classes. She always thought it would be a good thing to learn. And Mrs. Taylor was a real, in India there's the word guru, of course, which means spiritual teacher, but it also just means teacher in many fields. And she was like a choto guru. Choto means little guru. She was like a little guru to me, because in sewing I learned that you can't cheat. It's just as simple as that. If you don't baste it properly and put it in and just try to run it through the sewing machine, when you pick it up, it looks terrible. And when you try to repair it, if you only pull out half the stitches and then try to jam it back together, it still looks terrible. And everything that you do is reflected in the finished garment. And if you want the garment to look nice, you have to just do it step by step. There was no alternative to it. And it was very important learning for me, because sewing was the first place in my life I learned that you have to cooperate with reality as it is. And if you cooperate with you, if you slow down, get interested in the process, and just accept the law as it is and cooperate with it, then it will come out right. And if you don't, it doesn't. Period. And I've always enjoyed sewing, I think, because it's so direct. It's just, there it is, you know. But a lot of times what we're doing in life, is we're just saying in very, very sophisticated ways, I want it to be different. I want it to be different. You've many times heard me talk about this little 4-year-old boy who lived for 10 years. We had a big house. We, meaning, I used the cosmic we, meaning Ananda, even though I wasn't necessarily part of everything that Ananda ever did. But Ananda had a house in San Francisco. It was a 45-room mansion in the Pacific Heights. Oh, this fantastic view of the city. It was a beautiful place. But it was a big mansion with 5 stories, but right up the center of the house was this big wooden staircase, and the halls, there was a lot of wood in the halls, so the house was very, very echoey. And you were even up on the 3rd floor, the 5th floor was unrelated to the staircase, but everything that was related to the staircase you could hear everywhere in the house. And at 2 in the morning, this little 4-year-old boy who was so willful, he just got tired of having to sleep when he wasn't sleepy anymore, and he wanted something more interesting to happen. And he walked out of his room, and he stood in the middle of that staircase in the middle of the house, and he shouted with his whole voice, I want it to be morning. So he had just simply had it with it being night. And he just demanded of the universe that it make it morning. Of course, it didn't make it morning. It just woke everybody up. But he could not exercise sufficient willpower to change it like that. Now, the art of successful living is to understand divine law. I remember I used to talk about divine law, and this one poor gentleman who no longer comes here because I think I frustrated him so much. He kept coming at me with a little pad and paper and wanted me to tell him what the divine laws were. You know, like turn left, always signal, you know. I don't know what he wanted me to say. And I said, well, that's all I ever talk about. But somehow he wanted it down into some crystallization that I couldn't provide in the way he wanted. But divine law, It's not really about the divine. It's not about God in a personified, in the same way that my nephew regards me. Everything would be fine if you would just let me do what I want. You know, the only reason I got upset last night was because you didn't let me do what I want. No, the reason we didn't let you do what you want is because you were already so upset. You know, it was not like that wasn't what was happening. You were already unhinged, and therefore that was the end of the day. It was going to be over. And he insisted it wasn't true, but it was true. Because that was just the way things are. There is a way to live that creates harmony and that brings us what we really want. And Yogananda said all suffering is the result of being out of attunement with divine law. And he even said all failure is the result of being out of attunement with divine law. That if you're in attunement with divine law, everything comes out right. Because one of the other ways that the universe works is that everything is heading toward perfect happiness and perfect joy. And that is also one of the truths of this world, this consciousness that is life, is that it's all, its goal, and it will not rest until it reaches that, is perfect joy, perfect bliss, perfect freedom, perfect love. That's our nature. That's what we really are. Everything else that we experience is because we're out of sync with our own nature. Now, that also may not necessarily be obvious, just looking around. But we know that. And that's why this world frustrates us so much. Because we know in our hearts that we were meant to be happy. And we feel so cheated when it doesn't happen. If we didn't really know that we were meant to be happy, we would be happier not being happy. Do you know what I mean? It's because we know that this is wrong. Because there's a deep deeper than conscious memory of bliss as our real nature. And we just, we're not, the heart knows no rest until it has rediscovered that. It's not a matter of opinion. It's not a matter of anybody's dogma. It just is what it is. People call it God and build all sorts of things around it, but Yogananda made a fascinating statement. He said the only place God can be experienced is within the human nervous system, which just sounds such a clinical statement. It seems such a weird statement. But what he's really saying is that it is our own consciousness. There's nothing outside of us, and all the rest of it is just words to help us figure out what we're supposed to do. Now, the way that works is really also just thinking in terms of objective truth. Like, for example, if I were to light a candle in this room, we could have any opinion we want about that candle, but the nature of the candle is if you put your hand into it, it burns you. Unless you have, and I have to allow for this, unless you have so transcended the material world that you no longer see it that way. And I know people firewalk and all sorts of things. It can be done. But the nature of fire is to, and you can be furious at the fire for burning. And you can also sort of plead with the fire, or you could say to the fire, I'm going to give you one more chance, you know. I'm going to put my hand in you one more time, and I'm going to see if you really care about me enough not to burn me. You stick your hand in, you said, see, I told you, you don't love me, right? Because you burned my hand again. But the fire is quite impersonal. It doesn't really have an opinion about you. It doesn't really care about you. It's just simply being itself. And the great secret of facing life courageously is to really recognize how profoundly impersonal it is, even if persons are acting on you. That it's a very impersonal universe. There's just karmic laws, divine karmic laws, that are just going to act themselves out, and people will tune into what you need and give it to you. It's not even so much that they're giving it to you. It's that it needs to be given to you, and so somebody will give it. And it doesn't really matter. It's not like that person, even though they may believe that they have it in for you. But really, it's necessary for these experiences to come to you, and therefore people will give them to you. And even the instruments, no matter how intimate they seem, of both your blessings and your curses, it's really all very much just a divine play where all of these forces are playing together. Now, that doesn't mean that friendship isn't real, or love relationships are not real, or souls don't have special connections. They seem to have such a manifestation of sweetness. And he said, and he made the mistake in his mind of thinking that that person was sweet. And then that person became angry, and they weren't sweet at all. They were quite unpleasant, and you know, quite the opposite of what they had been. And then they became sweet again, and he realized, but therefore, it's not the person who's being sweet, because they're equally capable of being mean. He said, it's the quality of sweetness that comes through sometimes. And of course, if a soul has gotten really in tune with that, then you can experience that quality of sweetness particularly with them. Or if that person, such as we find in people that we really love, who really love us with nobility, that they are consistently able to harmonize themselves with that aspect of creation and be a consistent instrument for us. And therefore, they're good friends and they're good teachers, because they give us that constant experience, and they're people to emulate and to admire, because they're able to do it. But what we're really feeling is what they're channeling. You see, it's not that they are creating it; it's that they have learned to channel it, and to that extent, they teach us, you know, what it is that we need to learn, because we see it. We see the fruit. What is other people show us the fruit of certain kinds of behavior, and the people who are close to us, who love us well and that we love back, they show us the fruit of all that's required to create that, be it both within ourselves or in others. You know, people are often fond of saying, well, relationships take a lot of work. Well, relationships do take a lot of work. Everybody who's successful recognizes that. It takes just a mind-boggling amount of work. But it's not hard work, really, because the work of making a relationship successful is the work of staying awake enough to constantly stay in tune with what you really want to channel, instead of getting sucked into all sorts of other potentials, which are all there. You you know. And the work is not a between the two of you, kind of, although it may seem like that. The work is really with yourself and yourself to stay in tune with what you really want to channel. And then when you see other people getting out of tune with what they really want to channel and channeling anger or self-protectiveness or fear or selfishness, you experience what it feels like and you see what it looks like. And it's not attractive and it doesn't work as well as when you channel the other, and that gets to be a good lesson. I don't mean to, you know, make it so mysterious, because a lot of it is just about human personality too, but let me shift from there for a moment. I'll tell this story and then I'll give you a chance to comment, or we'll take a little break. But some of you have heard me tell this in other classes, but it's very appropriate to this situation. When I married David in 1981, 82, I had been single for 10 years. And I was quite happily single. I wasn't like I was looking to break that lifestyle. I just particularly like this man. So there you have it. But because I'd been single for a really long time, not quite 10 years, I was just real conscious of the patterns of my own mind not being mixed up with somebody else's energy. And I liked that a lot. And I had spent a lot of time really just working on myself and getting a handle on who I was and what made me tick. And then all of a sudden I found myself, you know, just totally enmeshed in this huge, you know, romantic love affair that was just really wonderful. But all of a sudden, all of the stuff that comes with that was just there in my life again after so long. And welcome, but not welcome. You know, it was a real mixed blessing. And I had been through a divorce 10 years earlier, and it had been very, very painful for me. And I wasn't really anxious to have that happen again. But at the same time, there we are. And I just had this day, and I don't know what was wrong with me, but I managed to work myself up into just a total upset. And it was particularly impressive, because I did that thing that women are much better at than men, which is just creating complete emotional chaos out of nothing. You know, with virtually no input from David, I managed to create a great upset between us. My mental picture of it is I kind of sat on the couch and like Pigpen just gradually created just chaos around me until, you know, he was genuinely upset and so was I. And that it was causeless. Just me wanting him to be different. If you loved me, you would X, Y, Z. You know, and then sitting in silence and wondering why he didn't know that I needed him to say this. You know, that kind of stuff that people do. And when I finally, you know, kind of created an explosion and then got the explosion calmed down, I started reflecting on, you know, this does not bode well. I'm really not looking forward to a lifetime of this kind of experience. I do not enjoy this. I'm not a person who likes that sort of thing. But I thought, but I'm in this, and you know, I'm in this relationship and I'm not going to leave it. I don't want to leave it either. But look what's happening here. So I started like trying to make myself feel safe and from these kinds of things by concentrating on David himself and what a fine person he is, which he is. You know, 20 years later, I can say the same energy. He's a wonderful man. And I wasn't wrong. You know, he's a great person. So I started concentrating on, you know, he's honorable, he's kind, he's loyal, you know, I can always rely on him, on all these different things that you try to say, which were, every one of them were true. But then I also just started thinking, but you know, here we are, we don't know what's going to come. We were in our 30s, we don't know what's going to come. And I thought about the thing that a lot of women worry about, what if he falls in love with someone else and, you know, really hurts me. And I think, well, it's not his nature to be disloyal. It's not his nature to be promiscuous or anything like that. But I thought, but you never know. I came out of the woodwork. He couldn't have anticipated that I was going to show up. And so what if really the greatest love of his life is 10 years down the road, And he's going to find himself after 10 years with me, finally meeting the really the right woman. You know, 20 years now, I understand that differently. But when I was sitting there still, I said, "And how could I, if I really care about him, how could I honestly dispute him if that's what he really felt? He will promise me that he has no intention of doing that, but he cannot promise me that he has no karma to have that happen. Do you see what I mean? The difference between that? In other words, none of us can make a promise beyond a certain point. Because after that, we just don't know ourselves well enough to know. Or now I think about things, what if he was in a terrible accident, became paraplegic? What if he had a brain injury? What if he had a stroke and became a different man? I mean, you know, all the really hard things that could happen that could just rip your life to pieces and not have it be the life that you bargained for. So I thought to myself, well, you know, I need to protect myself a little bit from the possibility of these things. And I began to think of my upset, and I thought, well, the reason that I got so upset is because I'm so open to him. I'm so open to him that if he breathes wrong, I can get upset. So maybe I need to be a lot less open to him. That's what I'll do. I'll just take my marbles and I'll go home. You know, that's how I'll deal with this. And I thought, well, you know, we've been together for 1 year. If I start solving problems by pulling back, you know, I know what that picture looks like. You know, you see it all over the place. You see these couples that have stayed together for 50 years, but they really should have separated about 49 ago. You know, just instead of using difficulties to overcome, they use difficulties to separate. I said, I just can't take that fork. But I said, but I'm too tender-hearted. I can't live through all the suffering either. So I thought to myself, well, what do I really trust? And then I realized that it's not, you don't trust people because you can't trust people. People can only be as good as they are. And it's a guarantee, as Swami often says, if they're inhabiting this planet, they're imperfect. Because if they were better, they wouldn't be here. You know, everybody's here because we're imperfect and we have something to learn, including ourselves. As Swamiji said once so charmingly, he said, if I expected perfection of my friends, I would be a very lonely man. You know, it's just not possible. And You can expect a sincere desire to do the right thing, but you can't expect perfection. So I said, well, what can I trust? And I thought, well, I can trust that God will bring me in my life exactly what I really need. I can trust my higher self to guide me to those experiences which are just the experiences that I need in order to learn the lessons that I need to learn in order to reach the goal that I'm really trying to reach, which is to have a constant experience of my true inner nature. And I have to admit, in all humility, that many, many things stand between me and that realization. If I were more fully realized, I would be more fully realized. I'm not. Therefore, a lot of things in me are going to have to be changed. And a lot of times, the only way we learn is because bad things happen to us. And when the bad things happen, it forces us to learn something we weren't going to learn. So the only thing I felt that I could really trust was that God would direct my life in the way that would ultimately bring me what I wanted. And if that meant that I would have a long and happy marriage, well, I would think that would be a really good plan. I mean, I was all for that plan. I wasn't neutral. I'm not detached. You know, I'm not detached from David. I'm not detached from having a happy home life. I want it. But what I want most of all is that I want to be in harmony with divine law. So if I can have both, hallelujah. But one is short-term, one is forever. So at that point, I realized that I absolutely need to stay open to whatever comes to me. But knowing that it's not, and this is how Swami, you know, you look at someone and you're really not trusting them. You're trusting that God will always come through them. And you're trusting your own karma. You're trusting that whatever comes to me is part of what my life needs, and therefore I will have the strength to handle it. And so you neither sort of hope for suffering or beg for happiness. You just ask for whatever needs to come to come. Okay, this takes us back to where Swami Kriyananda stands, the courage of the heart to take what's true. And you know, if most of the time when things screw up in my relationship, talking about that, I mean, I'm always at fault. I'm not always to blame. You know, David is not perfect. He has his areas where he has to learn. And very often he does things that cause me to be upset. But ultimately, my getting upset is because I, too, have issues that I have to learn. And so whatever comes, if we always can turn it to, oh, what good lesson is this going to teach me today? Then you may feel pain in the experience, but that pain is enormously mitigated by the sense of forward progress. And you begin to, I learned the first Christmas that I was at Ananda, and I think this is the secret of having an open heart, that you can exist on many levels at the same time. And the open-hearted commitment is to the highest level, recognizing that many things may happen on other levels. But if you maintain your openness to your faith in God and in the rightness of life going toward a real goal, which we have more time, I'll talk about how you build that, then anything can happen. The first year that I was at Ananda Village, and first Christmas, and again, some of you have heard me tell this, but it's absolutely apt to this situation. The first year I was there, I came to Ananda married, and by January, we were separated. And it was a total shock to me. I mean, he was a very fine fellow. We were very close. I did not think that was going to happen. It was obviously destined, and it was fine eventually, but in the happening, it was not at all fine. And it happened all over that first Christmas. Now, for years afterwards, on the other hand, that was the first time I had ever been in a really spiritual place, having really spiritual experiences, ever. I'd moved there in June, and you know, we'd sort of gotten into the rhythm, and Christmas was so beautiful. Besides, I was raised Jewish, so I didn't know anything about Christmas. I didn't know Christmas carols. I didn't know Christmas trees. I mean, all the wonderful traditions that Christian people grow up that are so beautiful were all just like fresh to me, and it was just, I was totally enamored of everything. And Kriyananda was there, and it was a very small community. There were like 30 or 40 of us. It was just very intimate and gorgeous. And oh, so deeply moving on the soul level. It was just life-changing. That for years afterwards, I would tell everyone about this, like astral heaven experience of Christmas at Ananda Village, and you must come, and even if your parents disinherit you, just come to Ananda Village for Christmas. And I have a big mouth, and I was just on and on and on for many years. About 6 or 7 or 8 years after all of this talk like this, one day when I was in the middle of this story, I have a very visual memory, and all of a sudden I had a visual memory. And the visual memory was Christmas Eve in what is, for those of you who've been there, the common dome, the dining dome at the seclusion retreat, which is this lovely room about 3 times the size of this one, curved room. We didn't have any electricity. It was lit with gas lights, so it was really mystical. This woman named Kalyani, who has this beautiful soprano voice, was sitting at a harmonium like this, but it had foot pedals. She was playing it like an organ. She was playing Christmas carols. Kriyananda was standing next to her. The two of them, like angels, were singing these Christmas carols together. It was so beautiful. I, however, was not actually in the warm circle. I was standing in this like 1 foot space behind the oil heater across the room. That's why my mental picture was actually looking at them from here, because I was back like this crying and just feeling utterly left out and bereft and sad because of all that was happening to me. And so, you know, the happier everyone else got, the more just morose and tragic I got. And so I just stood there and listened to them sing, sobbing against the heater. I was considerate enough not to sob in the middle of the music. I had the feeling that I should let them have their good Christmas, even if I couldn't, you know, like that. And then I had a couple of other just pictures that came of me standing on this big stool. I was cooking and stirring this huge pot like this with this big wad of tissue blowing my nose and sobbing on the other hand, cooking Christmas dinner, which I don't know, must have made them all sick. And there were, you know, there was, that was my Christmas as much as the other. But you know what? I forgot that. I mean, I literally, for years, forgot that it had been the most unhappy month of my life. I always remembered it as this really happy month. And I thought to myself, you know, what is this? And then the very simple thought, 2 level. You know? What was coming to me, I mean, it was all the things that my soul was rejoicing in. I found my spiritual family, I found my spiritual path, everything was so terrific. But also, my soul, my higher self, didn't really give a damn that my lower self was suffering, because we were getting on with it. You know, we were breaking the attachments, we were getting out of situations that weren't good for us, we were moving toward what we really needed, And so she's crying. Who cares? You know, happiness is on the other side of this. And it was. I mean, so much so that I didn't even know that the path to it had been a veil of tears. Just forgot. I mean, I could still find it. You know, I could still find all that suffering for a decade. I could find that suffering. But it didn't mean anything compared to what was really happening. And the art of being open-hearted is to always be open-hearted with the knowledge that nothing can ever really hurt me if I am. Because as long as I stay open, I will be moving forward. And the only way you can really suffer, and I don't mean suffer short term, I mean really big time suffering, is to refuse to go forward. Because our happiness lies in our expansion of consciousness, and we will always be limited in our happiness until we expand our consciousness. And we're so stupid that we cling to our contractive nature, and so God rips it out of our hands, and we think we're being hurt. But we're not being hurt, we're just being asked to grow up. It's 100% analogous of children. And if we just think of ourselves like children and think of everything you know about children and how a parent instructs a child and what a child has to do to respond properly, you know, and children can have tantrums just like we can, it's fine. And, you know, then expect to be locked in your room, you know, and expect that your tantrum is actually going to have ultimately no effect whatsoever on how Divine Mother treats you. Because, just as my sister said, you know, have I ever changed my mind when I talk to you like this? Because she couldn't, because she really loved her son more than she loved herself. And so she would not, absolutely would not give in. And if we would just look at our own lives that way, and think of it like that, say, well, why am I having this tantrum? You may have to weep, because we do get invested, and it is painful. And that's just the way it is. But we weep because we weep, not because we really want it to be different. You see the difference? Well, that turned out to be a very long opening statement. Since this lady's left us, should we take a couple of minutes and then we'll come back? Let's take a few minutes here. Go on. I gave a very long introductory story. So does anyone have any questions or comments or thoughts about what I said before we talk about more?
I'm just wondering, do you ever review it? I mean, is it, you know, when these things happen?
Oh, he reviewed it very profoundly. In fact, the effect of that whole experience was that for many months he was quite withdrawn, actually. But he wasn't withdrawn out of embarrassment. He was withdrawn because he had followed his guidance with a tremendous amount of zeal, and it had blown up in his face. And that cast into question the fundamental basis of his life, which is the ability to follow his own intuition. So for months, he just was very disengaged on a certain level because he didn't quite know how to engage, because the premise had been shaken. And then one day in meditation, he realized that nothing of the form of what he thought was going to occur had occurred, but that a tremendous energy shift had taken place because of all the action. You know, so that he realized that, in fact, it was just exactly what was supposed to happen, that he had changed, that Ananda Village had changed, many things that needed to happen happened, but he hadn't noticed that all that had taken place because he was so busy thinking about what hadn't gone the way he expected it. And so in and of itself, it was also a very important lesson, because we often think that a certain form, a certain external expression is what we're striving for, whereas that really isn't what we're striving for ever. What we're striving for is the inner experience that we believe that form will give us. Understand? I mean, thinking about a family, which is an obvious thing that we want. I mean, what a family gives us is companionship, you know, so we're not so lonely. It gives us a sense of people, to something to serve. It gives us a constant experience of joy. It keeps us from being bored. It gives us direction in our lives. I mean, you can make a long list of. It allows us to make a meaningful contribution. To really give to others. I mean, there's lots of long lists of what it is. But those are all qualities of consciousness. They're not really a description of any form. There are common forms that we want. And in my own life, when I found myself living at Ananda Village in this dedicated spiritual environment without a husband, without children, and at that point I thought I would never marry, I just was so astonished that I had ended up there. I just couldn't believe that, given where I had come from earlier in my life, that this is where I ended up. It just seemed so odd to me. But as I reflected on it more deeply, I actually realized that my inner sense of what I wanted had been just like a straight line. I mean, I always knew exactly what I wanted, but I just had to keep learning what it really meant. And because, as I said earlier, I had wanted, you know, happiness, and I didn't want a path that I didn't think would bring it to me, I sort of reduced all that down, that I really needed to do something that was meaningful, and the most meaningful thing I could think of was human love and motherhood and helping children. And that was what I decided I would do, you know, and I really, really thought that's what I was going to do. So to find myself without family, without children, and without any expectation, even a conscious commitment never to have any of those things, was so weird. But what I really also realized is that what I wanted out of getting married and having a big family, which is what I thought I would have, is I wanted to expand my consciousness. And I wanted to expand my sense of self, because I felt very small, and I really didn't like the feeling of being small. I wanted to be bigger. And so I thought, if I made children, which people can do, you know, I would be bigger. And then also I would do something that would matter to the world in helping those children. But that's what I wanted. I wanted to expand my consciousness. I wanted to expand my sense of self. I wanted to do something that mattered. And what I felt was the most important thing was love. And then I realized that's exactly, to the letter, what I was doing with my life. It just had flipped, though, completely from the form I thought it would take. And if we talk on a very deep spiritual level, the whole point of what the spiritual path is recognizing the consciousness behind the form. And so what happens in life is that if we mistake the form for the consciousness, eventually we have to grow out of that. You know, now whether or not we have the karma to have everything work out for a few lifetimes, you know, I mean, it doesn't mean that everything has to be tragic. Because Swamiji said something else that is so extremely important. He said, first of all, he said to me, he said, God doesn't want you to be unhappy. He said, that's what you impose on the situation. It's not that God, you know, that I'm suffering, therefore this must be God's will. That was the great mistake of Christianity when they decided to focus on Jesus nailed to the cross instead of Jesus resurrected. I mean, there was no reason why the picture had to be him nailed to the cross. It could have just as easily been Jesus resurrected. But they picked the one of him nailed to the cross. So the whole picture of spirituality in the West has been, if you suffer, that means you're pleasing God. And so we have this mistake in our mind that when we suffer, therefore that must be what God wants. You know, look how much I'm suffering. But in the Festival of Light every week we say, whereas in the past suffering and the sorrow was the coin of man's redemption, for us now that has been exchanged for calm acceptance. Meaning that you, just because things are coming out differently than you expected them to come out, you don't have to suffer. You can just calmly accept that and recognize the joy that's behind it. It takes a lot of willpower, and you sometimes have to live on two levels. But the other thing I was going to say is that Swamiji said, we learn a lot from being frustrated, you know, from having our desires frustrated. We do learn something from that. He said, but we learn much more from having our desires fulfilled. In other words, it's eventually God will give you what you want. Because until you have it, you're going to believe that it's going to make you happy. It's just as simple as that. And once you have it, it's not that it will make you unhappy, but it will not give you the kind of happiness that you know you really want, because it can't. It's just as simple as that. It can't. There's nothing on the planet that can satisfy the real longing of our soul. And that's why, what happens, you know, you marry, you have a wonderful family, you live in a beautiful home. Everything goes beautifully, eventually, in one incarnation or another. And it is absolutely wonderful. But it isn't enough. And then we have to look for what we're really looking for. But having had the fulfillment that all those things can give us, that's why in the scripture it says it's very fortunate to be born to wealth. Because then you just get to buy everything you want, and you don't have to sort of spend all your lifetime trying to get wealth so you can buy some of those things so you can find out whether they'll make you happy. You can finish it out before you're 20. So it's good karma to be wealthy. It's good karma to have good relationships. I mean, it's very good karma. Because then you get to drink that cup right to the bottom and appreciate it, how beautiful it is, and then recognize that I need to go more than this. That doesn't mean you have to give it up even. You know, you just have to go deeper and recognize what it is that you're really wanting in that. Now, what did you ask me originally that caused me to say that? Did I answer your question? Okay. He reflected. He reflected profoundly on it. Right, and now I remember. He reflected. Because you have to learn. I mean, I said, Swami, what should you do when you do something wrong? He said, you should look right at it. You should learn everything that you can from the experience, and then you should put it out of your mind forever. You know, you just have to look right at it and learn everything you can. But don't worship it.
You know? But that's the I was just going to say just about the guidance part, because if it doesn't come out right and you feel like you're really following your guidance or what you think is right, perhaps what you promised people or told people that was going to happen, then I guess what I'm hearing is that you need to look at it at a different way.
God sends you what you're supposed to have. And you don't. It doesn't mean that you were wrong. You may have what you called guidance, you may have misread, you may have misheard it, you may have distorted it, you may have been more subconscious than superconscious, but even that is fine, because that's what was trying to happen. But everything, I remember once saying, there was a decision that someone had to make, and they really wanted Swami to say, is this a good thing or a bad thing? He said, no, it's nothing. He said, it's good if you make a good thing of it, it's bad if you don't. That's all. It's neutral. So when things quite have come out wrong, they haven't really come out wrong, they've just come out. I mean, periodically through years, I mean, one of the things about living in community as long as I have with the same people, you know, I mean, we've cloned, and so now there's, you know, circles, bigger circles. But still, Durga Madura came last night, they're really some of our closest friends. We've known each other for 25 or more years. Sometimes I even joke, I say we've known each other too long, you know, but I'm only joking. But we have been through so many embarrassing moments, you know, just really catastrophically awful things. And so often over the course of time, now that people have been here for a long time, 8, 10 years, you know, somebody will just screw up in a really big way. Just do something really embarrassing. There's no other word for it. You know, just have a relationship that just, you know, goes ballistic in the middle of the courtyard, or a job scene that just falls to pieces, or a big, I am guided to do X, Y, and Z, and then a year afterwards, it's just zip, it's not anywhere. And I always say to them, this is as important, you know, maybe the whole point of this was for you to be able to just look at yourself, look at everyone around you and say, ha, well, what do you know? You know, screw up number one. This is your chance to just hold your head up and just keep walking. And that's, if you can learn to do that, then you can really learn. Because if when that happens to you, you suddenly feel that all of a sudden now I have to crawl back into my hole and pull the covers up over my head. I mean, think how slow your progress is. Because I've always been in favor of the crash and burn method. You know, you just go full out, push the accelerator to the floor, run it as far as you can. If it works, if you make it, fantastic. If you crash, you just put the bandages on and pick up the pieces and try to build your little car again. But the ability just to accept that, at least I'm trying. And that's why we use this phrase, don't worship your mistakes. There was this very important story. The woman, it was Tara Mata, who helped Yogananda edit Autobiography of a Yogi. She was a very, you know, prominent and well-respected, although horrible woman also, in Yogananda's life, a direct disciple, beloved direct disciple. At a certain point, she decided to get married. Yogananda said, do not do this. This is a bad thing for you to do. She said, meh, I'm going to do it anyway. She left the monastery. She moved across the country. She got married. She had a child. It was a disaster, just as he promised. And so after a few years, she came back. You know, she's child in tow. She just came back, knocked on the door and said, well, I'm back. He, of course, said, fine. You know, I'm glad you learned something. Welcome back. He didn't care. Others said, oh, how could you? You know, he told you not to, and you disregarded him. And now you have the nerve to show your face again. And she was a very acerbic woman. Said, huh, what do you expect me to do? Worship my mistakes for the rest of my life? It was just, that was the answer. I made a mistake. Big deal. You know, I'm not going to make that the altar of my life from now on. But see, that's what we do. And Swamiji's remark about it was so perfect. He says it's so egotistical because it's based on the fact of, I made a mistake. How could I make a mistake? You know, of course I could make a mistake. You're going to make a gazillion mistakes. And so we make a mistake. It's like it's not this big, like, well, life has ended, big earth-taking revelation. I have made a mistake. I've just made a mistake. I make so many. Who cares? And this is just one more. And we all know that anybody who's light about the things that happen to them, it's a light experience. You know, people who can just openly and casually say, well, what do you know? I tried. You know, I could choose to be very embarrassed, but and everything is a mess, and I'm sorry for what I caused, but, you know, I tried. I was so sincere. We did our little best. I used to joke a lot because things would go wrong in Ananda so much. Ananda Village, it was just always, and I would sometimes say, oh, my God, we're so sincere. You know, we may be incompetent, but we're so sincere. And that just, in whatever way you can, Kriyananda has always trained us to make lots of jokes about things, make lots of jokes when you're not feeling upset about things that you might get upset about later. So that you just kind of get in the habit of taking it lightly. You know, and he's a tease. He teases people about things a lot when he knows that it's a good moment to train you to be able. And once he was teasing me, and I said, oh, Swamiji, you're making fun of me. He said, very serious. He said, no, not actually. I'm not making fun of you. He said, I believe I'm taking advantage of the fun which is already present. And I've always just enjoyed that. I mean, why not? I remember once he sang, the whole of love is a many splendored thing, in the most maudlin, just appalling way to this hopelessly romantic girl who had just gotten herself into nothing but trouble with her romanticism. I don't know how he started it, but he was just sort of, and you know, and she was caught between the fact that she'd always loved that song and the fact that he was doing it in such a way as to help her realize that, you know, this is not a good attitude for you. I'll have to tell you another story in that way. There was this couple, they've since separated, but it was her birthday, and we were at a restaurant together, we were a group of us, and he was a good singer. And she said to him, they were both characters, she said, sing to me, there's a restaurant, sing to me, sing if I could ever leave you. And so he sang it just so sweetly, it was so beautiful, he really did sing it to her, lovely. And all of us watched, and it was so touching, and everybody who had a husband was thinking, you know, oh. And so Joe, Tish, and Davey were there. This is this couple who are real leaders of Ananda, and they have a wonderful relationship for 25 years. And Davey turned to Joe, Tish. They have a good sense of humor. And she said, Joe, Tish, you never sing to me. And Joe, Tish leaned over like this, and he said, Old MacDonald had a farm. He got all the way to the oink oink here and the oink oink there. You know? It was just perfect. You know, everybody else at the table just relaxed. It was just like, we don't have to do this. But just when it's easier, developing that spirit about yourself, just put out the things that you're really attached to and that would really embarrass you. And just try to get a little perspective. You know, so that when they really come and want to torture you, some little part of you remembers that I know that I'm being tortured now, but this is also. And then that just kind of moves you to the time. All right, I can stand back and look at this. I mean, the worst experiences are the funniest. Later. Later. Yeah, seriousness causes reincarnation. You worship your mistakes, and then you just have to keep reliving them. But learn from your mistakes. That's different. And again, this is courage. Many of you know in Kriyananda's life, one of the most explosively difficult things that has ruled his life ever since is that in the early 60s, he was thrown out of SRF. Self-Realization Fellowship was the organization that Yogananda founded. A big, just huge thing, enormous thing. The details of it are unimportant for this, except that the thing that really just caused the explosion was that he was living and working in India, and he went forward with this terrifically aggressive plan to get land in the city of New Delhi to build a temple for Self-Realization Fellowship. And he did. He succeeded in getting Nehru, who was the prime minister at that time, to give him land in the center of New Delhi, in an area where 2,500 other religious societies had tried to get land, and he succeeded in getting the land. When he wired back to America that he was doing that, they thought he was trying to set himself up as his own organization, separate from them. It's much more complicated than that, but it just blew up. And he ended up as a fully professed monk, being thrown out of the monastery and everything. And of course, thank God, because none of what you're sitting in and experiencing now would exist if all that hadn't happened. It was the best possible thing that ever happened to us. There's no question about that. But it wasn't great for him at the time.
But let me
just give you the most interesting part of this. He told us the story of getting thrown out of SRF over and over again for 20 years. 15 years maybe. Over and over. We heard it so many times because there were many things in it that were pertinent. And one time, he started telling a whole other part of the story. He said, you know, when I was in India and I needed to do something to make something happen, I knew I really needed to do something. So I had this idea of trying to get this land in New Delhi. I did not feel the kind of intuitive guidance I usually feel, he said, before I undertake such a project. But I thought, well, let me conduct an experiment. I'll go forward and see what happens when I act without it. But I thought to myself, among other things, what courage, you know, just to say, I really want to know. I'm just going to go forward and see. I mean, of course, it was the right thing and blah, blah, blah. But how much, you know, you see the fruit of that kind of courage, and you recognize, at least I do, as I was describing to you, this man's brilliance is from the courage of the heart. But you think, how do you get that courage? Well, inch by inch. I mean, he, because of the nature of the magnitude of his consciousness, you know, it had to be big. But, so, we take the size step that's ours. You just take, and I need to get to this, I mean, you just take the little tiny places. And people ask me, how do you transform yourself? I say, you start step by step, and you start where it's easy. You know, we always think that we should start with the big, you know, somebody will say to me, you know, my mother and I have this really horrible relationship, so I'm going to move in with her and try to work it out. I say, wait, you know, are you getting along with your boss? Why don't you try to get along with the person you work for first, okay? You know, just practice where it's easier, because here's some reasons for it which are really important. What we need above all is to keep our hope and our sort of positive energy. I mean, positive energy is the most important thing, and positive energy comes when we have hope. We mustn't lose hope, ever. And we must keep a sense of confidence within ourselves that I can do this. And for that reason, it's very important to undertake projects that we actually can do. And sometimes it's a strange thing when we're trying to protect some aspect of our nature, we will always try to achieve something that we know that subconsciously we know is impossible so that we can prove to ourselves that it can't be done. Do you see what I mean? And that's why a lot of times people are not practical, because they don't really want things to change. They just want to have the satisfaction of thinking that they're doing something. The ego satisfaction often. If you really want to change, you do things that are actually attainable. And Yogananda put it in that way by saying, if a test is too big for you and you know you can't win, he said, the better part of wisdom is to run away. I've always loved that. Because you don't want to constantly be defeated. Because then you get the thought in your mind that you're hopeless and you can't do it. You know? So instead of sort of saying, oh, I want to have my life partner, I really need my mate, you know, and I'm just sort of, I can keep trying to find your mate. You know, you don't really need your mate. What you need is more of a flow of love in your life. I mean, that's what you're thinking. I'm lonely. I need to get on with, you know, what my life is about. I need intimacy, or I need whatever I need. I want to have the experience of loving more. Well, instead of sort of saying, oh, I need that, which I can't even see or imagine or have no strings even attached to, in order to have this, you have to say, well, here I stand. I want to get to there, so I need to move this foot. You know, like, what is happening in my life? What is right in front of me that is about the consciousness? And how can I move into that? You know, karma does not shift. And as Swamiji says, nature doesn't make sudden changes. You know, it's not like you've got a little shoot like today and you've got a tulip tomorrow. You know, there's all these very obvious, almost indiscernible little steps where that bulb underground turns into the tulip above ground. The tulip was where the bulb was going, but the only way the bulb could get there was in direct relationship to what it was. You know, first it's a tulip, and then there's a little crack, and there's a little shoot, then there's the ground. You can see it. But we're sitting here lacking all these many things, and we think that we can get from here to there without working with what we are. So there's always, whatever it is that you desire, there is always, I guarantee it, an opportunity to begin to express it right where you're sitting. But often we don't want those choices because, ooh, those are real choices. You know, that's going to be hard work. It's going to be extremely unglamorous. Nobody's going to pay any attention to us. And we might actually have to change instead of just have the pleasure of thinking that we want to change. Right? And life is really awful that way. I mean, it's just a series of really, really boring things. One after another. That may eventually lead to lovely things. But the other side of it is very satisfying, because if we need to be more open-hearted and loving, then we start today. You know, we start the next time we go to the Walmart by actually looking at the people who are checking us out and really talking to them and really projecting Divine Mother's love into them, not inappropriately, but just appropriately as it should be done. We start by being patient with ourselves. We start by loving the space we live in. We start a long time ago that never got out. I just remember that.
You said so many things, it's hard to...
Yeah,
I have many questions, but I forgot them all. I have one that struck me as somewhat poignant. You said about divine law, you said, you know, if divine law is working correctly, you don't fail. Is that what you said?
I said failure is the result of being out of attunement with divine law. That's a quote from Yoga. Failure is the result of being out of attunement with divine law.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I myself said, but Swamiji, sometimes it's people's karma to fail. I mean, and he said, yes, but it's only a temporary stage, and eventually. But failure also has to be understood. It's not that you're ultimately going to win the lottery or, you know, land the big contract or something like that, because as you get wiser, your desires shift. Yeah, so it's not like every single worldly external objective, as you get more and more in harmony, you will be able to do X, Y, and Z, because you won't want to do X, Y, and Z anymore. I mean, Jesus could have manifested anything, but he didn't. He was in complete harmony with divine law, so he didn't want to anymore. So it sort of works like that. But another way of saying it is, everything that comes to you that appears to be a failure is just to teach you something that will give you the keys to success. Either literally the keys to success in your business or in your relationship, because everything that comes to you is telling you the reason this person is responding to you is because somewhere that was the response that was required because of who you are. And if that's not a response that you like, then we need to learn what it is. And it's not always, it's very important to realize, it's not always about, you know, I'm mean, or I need to be meeker, I need to be nice. It might not be. It could easily be, you know, what's wrong here is that I sit here and take this from you. You know, well, the right response to this is to say, how dare you speak to me like this? You know, there's something in us that may think I deserve this kind of abuse. And that's why I keep getting it. So don't think that it's just about blessed Jesus, meek and mild, you know. Sometimes it's about picking up the whip and driving the money changers out of the temple. Why does this keep happening to me? Because on some level I'm out of attunement with divine law. And divine law includes my sense of importance too. To say, that's why self-forgetfulness is not the same as worthlessness. Self-forgetfulness means that I see myself in right proportion to everything else. And to be abused is not to see yourself in right proportion. Do you see what I mean? So we have to respond appropriately. It's always, and sometimes we're very afraid, and we need to learn to fight. Sometimes the appropriate thing, to speak of my nephew again, because he's so much in my mind, he has the karma to always, he's been teased a lot. He was just telling me this morning, he's very unusual. He's very, very big brain. He has a huge brain. And he said, I've only ever just fought back with my words, he said. But in first grade, he said, I would fight back with my words and they didn't even know what I was saying. Nobody in first grade even knew what a dimwit was. So he would devastate them with insults and they didn't even know they'd been insulted, you know. But this last school year, he really was subject to a lot of bullies. He has had a very hard time. And my sister had taught him to use his words, of which he's very good at. But it wasn't working. So finally, the last week of school, she said, you should just punch them, because she began to realize that he just really needed to punch them. So he just went and punched them all. And he felt so great. And he was very impressed by the fact that only one of them hit him back. You know, I mean, the appropriate response for him was to recognize that he should just hit them. He shouldn't take it anymore. And that was great. It was absolutely great advice. Kind of has transformed him. But it took my sister a whole year to realize that that was what was really happening. And then after all her careful training to teach him one way, she needed to tell him to just fight back. But for us, too, that can often be true. I mean, I don't know whether we need to come to physical blows, but sometimes you might, because that's just what's required. In his own autobiography, Swami Kriyananda's book, The Path, which is very interesting, the first part of it is about his own upbringing. And there's quite a few instances of physical fights that he had as a child. You know, quite a few times he had to fight. And, you know, he was very selective in what he put there, but I know it was not undeliberate. And he talked about how he was never afraid to fight, and he never did more than was necessary. But he did absolutely what was necessary. And usually he would just try to, you know, overcome the person, and then that would be enough. But another interesting incident he talks about was a real bully that he had in boarding school, who was this great big lad, and Kriyananda was always a thin, small person. This boy was a little bit out of his mind. And the boy just broke into his room and held Swami down on the bed as a little boy and started pounding on him. And Kriyananda couldn't do anything, so he just became completely passive and just let the man spend his temper. And as he put it, he said, I really thought he was going to kill me. And then, I don't know, I think he got distracted. Something happened. Or else Swami's total lack of resistance just gave the bully nothing to work with, and so he ran away. I don't remember exactly. But later, someone said, well, why didn't you call for help? And Swami's answer was, I wasn't afraid. And I thought, that's really something. But that's the, you do what's appropriate because you're not afraid. You know, you fight if you need to. And my little nephew was afraid to fight. And it became obvious to his mother that it was really important that if he didn't show that he had the courage to fight back against these boys, it was really going to damage him much more than being bullied. But it was the self-image that was growing in him that was much more dangerous. And now he tells me very proudly that he just punched them all. You know, he's just real. And she said he just transformed in 2 days after he just started hitting back, and he became finally like this. So the lesson isn't always just to sit there. It's to just be what you need to be. And see, if you're not afraid of that, then also you don't have to be so afraid of being hurt. We put it in another context. I mean, what is it to be hurt? It's to be powerless in the face of things. And so we need to develop a self-image of being very powerful, because then you can't be hurt. I mean, things can happen to you, But if you're not afraid, they just happen to you. You know, okay, I thought I was going to live this happy life in a certain way, but I didn't. So now I have a different life. So what am I, why do I have to cry for help? What am I afraid of? It's just a different life now. But you have to practice that little. I mean, little. You know, you're on your way to work with your computer and the thing freezes up. Do you have a temper tantrum? Or do you just in that moment, I'm open to what's happening, I just turn in a new direction? You know, you're trying to drive somewhere and the traffic's really bad, do you become all agitated because the traffic's bad, or do you just open your heart? And we don't think of this as opening our heart, but we just open our heart to whatever's in front of us and go with that. You know, I planned to have this, I planned to have that, I didn't get it. Do I just open my heart to this new situation and go on? Do you see? It's just always right there in front of you. And the great big closing down is always the result of all the little closings down. And maybe you're very open in certain areas and very closed in others. Just go right to the areas where you are and find some baby steps for yourself to take. Some steps that you can take so that you can say afterwards, see, I did that. I did that. It wasn't hard. I did that. You need to take steps that are just the same size, the right size, so you can say, see, I did that. I did this all by myself. And then you get really good at that, and you take the next and the next, and pretty soon you've got a tulip. And you don't really know how you got a tulip, but you got a tulip. I work with it on, I'm afraid of icky people. I mean, really big-time icky people, like street people and things like that. I'm afraid of them in the sense that I have a very, very vulnerable heart to people's sufferings. You know, I think something's wrong with my aura, and I get people's thoughts and I get their feelings a lot. And then I've also begun to recognize that I project my own on them. So I see these mad people or people pushing their carts and I'm afraid of them because I'm afraid to feel their energy for fear that it'll hurt me. But recently I've realized that's not good. What am I afraid of? I'm not afraid they're going to hurt me. Sometimes I'm in my car. I'm afraid of the fact that people in this world suffer. And if I'm afraid of the fact that people in this world suffer, it's kind of a real impractical thing to be afraid of. Because what do you know? People in this world suffer. So I've been just really trying hard to practice. Every time that fear of other people's suffering comes to me, I try to really, really relax deeply in my heart and really really look at them. And this works the best, truly, when you're in your car and you're not, for me, I mean, if I'm too close, I can't. I just really try to really look at that person and just realize, you know, they're just having their experience. You know, whatever it is, it's the experience that they set up for themselves. They drink too much, or they took drugs, or they tried to escape responsibility by going crazy. You know, or bad things happened to them and they refused to deal with them and now they're here. But that's all that's happening. You know, it's not more than that. It's just a soul going through its thing. Why am I so afraid of it? And so I practice. I practice whenever I have the courage to practice. And it really, really helps. Then I forget and I start being all nervous again. And I think, wait, you know, let's forget this. Let's not be. You know, I've spent all my life worshiping the fact that I'm so sensitive. I'm really sick of it. I don't want to be so sensitive. I want to have courage. Because otherwise, you know, there's just a whole domino effect that goes down from that. You see what I mean? But that's a baby step for me. That's a step that I can do. I can look at one homeless person and not be afraid of the fact that they're homeless and suffering. And every time I have one of those victories, I feel so good. Really. I mean, when I really can just go right into them and not worry about it. Does that make sense?
You give them $5?
Sometimes. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I have to give them money in order to do it. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't need to. Because I look right at this person and I think, you know, you've just really messed up your life and I'm not going to help you anymore. You need to face what you have to face. You can take this money and go drink with it. I'm not going to give it to you. But I'm not afraid of that either, if I'm having a good day. But see, that's what I meant about appropriate. See, to not be afraid of them doesn't mean that I have to, sometimes to give them money is because I'm afraid of them. Sometimes when I'm not afraid of them, I don't have to give them any money. Because I'm just not afraid to let this man just go out and die on the street if he needs to. Because that's what he's determined to do, or she's determined to do. Well, let's take it from a different angle, Marcia. Now, people are also happy, and there gets to be this, and there gets to be an orientation where we focus on what isn't working in the world around us. People are also beautiful and courageous, and kind and good, and unhappy. It's all happening at the same time. So first of all, there is an orientation to pick up the dark. And so that you have to work with that orientation. I mean, I have the same thing. I mean, why am I always oriented to pick up this? Partly because, I'll speak for myself, and I don't know if it's true for you, I've defined myself with pride because I'm so sensitive. And there's a certain ego involved in being able to kind of do that. So I've had to like work on myself like, this is not such a great quality. This is a weakness. This is not a strength. To sort of always be, think of it, again, I'll use Swami as an example. Swami and another man had dinner with this couple in Italy, this business associate. And they're very worldly people, very, very just different. And afterwards, Prahlad was with Swami, and he said, oh, I'm so glad to get away from them. I mean, there was so much negativity between that couple. And Swami said, there was? Like that. But then he stopped to think, and he had never said, oh, there's so much negativity between this couple. But he realized that everything he did all night long was trying to bring harmony and trying to bring them up. But he had done that, he had responded appropriately without ever calling it bad. You see, he had just looked at, and he'd felt the people's need and tried to give, instead of feeling the need and then defining it and then getting all involved in himself about it. And oftentimes with Swami, I've realized he'll just remember the progress people have made. He will not remember the problem from which they are progressing. That he's trained himself to look at people and see their potential, rather than look at them and seeing what their delusion. And more than that, you are actually helping them then. When you look at them and what you feel is, oh my God, you're suffering so much. Whether you say it or not, what they feel in your company is, oh my God, I'm suffering so much. And you're not a lot of fun to be around. Because what you're putting out to them is an increased awareness of what they already know. But when you look at them and you think, my, aren't you courageous? You know, my, aren't, don't you have a wonderful opportunity to grow? Whoa, look at how you're enduring this. Then all of a sudden the person feels stronger when they're with you. And it's really just a question of turning your thoughts around. And my Seva said to me just 2 weeks ago, it was so helpful. She's just said, somebody, you said critical. Seva was talking to me. Seva's a friend, again, one of my 30-year friends. But she said, I've had a habit, she said, for my whole life of looking at situations and seeing what was wrong with them and looking at people and seeing the negative. And she said, I just realized I had to squeeze those thoughts out of my mind. I loved the image. And she says, and now when I am confronted with someone, by a conscious act of will, I squeeze out all those habitual negative thoughts and I just, by willpower, I replace them with positive thoughts. I replace them with positive perceptions. And there was a point, I've known Seva all this time, where she really went into a tailspin and then she just came out of it like that. And she said she just sort of started always seeing what was wrong. And then one day she just saw what it was doing to her. It was doing nothing for her. And she just started squeezing those thoughts out of her mind. And when every time she'd look at anyone, she would just, as soon as the negative would start, she'd just start in concentrating on the positive. It's just a habit. You have to realize that. It doesn't exist. See, this idea of being sensitive and all that, we have this idea that it really exists. It doesn't exist. It's a habit. It's a habit of tuning in on that level and picking it up. And it's a habit that can be changed. But it takes willpower to change it, and it takes the desire to be somebody else. We like being like that. It gives us an identity. To lose that is to lose a lot. I read the funniest thing. I mean, funny in a horrible way. You know, Prozac is this antidepressant that people take. There's a little article in the paper that someone sent me that said, psychologists have discovered that people who take Prozac go into a period of grief because they mourn the loss of their former tormented self. And I thought, that's true, because I have an identity as a depressed person, and if I'm not depressed anymore, then who am I? And so I have an identity as an oversensitive person who's easily upset by other people's grief, and you know, there's a lot in there that makes me feel special. And if I'm not going to have that anymore, who am I going to be? Besides, we always prefer the known to the unknown. But you know, you speak of critical, it's just, people are all so good. And we have to recognize that we are poisoning our own reality. And we just have to concentrate on the fact that this is a poison attitude and nobody will suffer but me. And the second, I love the word habit. I love to say habit. This is just a habit. This is just a pattern of energy that I have just habitually set this way, but I can look right at someone and think something else. And I find affirmations really useful, memorized affirmations that you can just shout inside your head when the other ideas come in. And just take all the space that was filled by these bad ideas and just blow it out with something else. And it's great. I also, for a period of time, I would put my hand over my mouth every time I heard my mouth doing things that I didn't want it to do. That became quite socially unattractive, so I stopped. But it was just, it was like my way of trying to say, I'm just not going to be this person anymore. And it didn't matter if I was in the middle of a sentence or where I was. Yeah, cancel. No, I didn't mean that. Let's start over again. That's why I find affirmations that you've memorized or songs, chants, very, very helpful, because what you can concentrate on is not letting your mind be idle. And that, just like whenever your mind is just wandering, you just start repeating the affirmation. And that's the beginning of trying to get some mastery over what's going on in there. And really, yes, of course, it's very difficult, but if you don't start, you'll never accomplish it. And if you even have a half a minute once a week, that's a whole half a minute once a week. I do very simple things. I make signs. I put signs around my house. You know, I try to make mental associations between this thing and that thing, that whenever this happens, this is what I'll remember. One emotional response that I used to have that I couldn't control, I really got myself tuned into the sound of my voice once I was caught in that cycle. And that I knew that my voice assumed a certain sound, certain stridency, that my words got really fast, and I usually started moving around. And so I just really impressed upon my mind to pay attention. And so that it, and then gradually it got so that once that sound started, I knew that I had to stop. And so as soon as I heard that sound, I would stop. And so you can get kind of like key ideas in the most dramatic moments, but if you get a hold of it anywhere, you can, it's the bulb in the ground. You know, if you can just get a little tiny shoot going, you can grow a tulip. And it may not look like much, but it will become a tulip if you work with it long enough. If you say, well, that's not enough, then you just remain a numb. Do you see what I mean? Now, let me be sympathetic. Oh, yeah, it's really hard. this is not easy. But the fruits are commensurate with the effort. And it's the only game in town. Because otherwise, this is the result, you know. It's just not worth it. Yeah, and then we'll just get to do it again and again and again and again. But even the desire, and here's the other part that's really important, which is that this is swimming with the current. When you try to be in harmony with divine law, you're suddenly swimming with the current. And even though you may not be able to dog paddle any better than you were before, you are moving with the current, and you'll be surprised what comes to you. And God takes mercy on us. God helps those who help themselves. And even just the sincere wish, even the, oh, damn, I forgot for a whole day. And then you rail a bit at Divine Mother. You have got to help me. Yogananda says you make a prayer demand. You say, look, you left me all by myself today and I just made a mess. I never thought one time, not once, about what I was supposed to do, and I was right there and you could have reminded me. Just take out all your annoyance on Divine Mother and just demand. And all that makes an impression on your mind too. And the next day when you're starting to slip, you'll remember you had a tirade last night about this very thing in your meditation room. And that's why I was sort of saying exaggerate. Make jokes. Exaggerate. Be extreme. Consciously be extreme. Because that'll help you remember. That's why you need to do it. Because it's all about remember. There's a word for it. The word is smriti. It's a Sanskrit word, smriti, which means memory, divine memory. Just remembering who we really are. And it ultimately means remembering that we are one with the infinite, but it also means to remember that I don't have to be the victim of this particular habit. I can awaken the memory of a higher habit, a higher self. And you think it's not working, and then years go by, and you suddenly realize that you have become somebody else, and you don't remember when. I had this wonderful experience when I'd been at Ananda Village about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. When I first came, I had these little dark frame glasses and my hair parted in the middle and I wore little braids. It was very tight. I was quite thin and I was very tight. And I had the name my parents gave me, Asha, is the name I've gotten from Kriyananda more recently. Well, now, 25 years, but more recently than my birth name. But for a few years at Ananda Village, I was known by the name my parents gave me. And so I used to work in the kitchen at the seclusion retreat, and I met a lot of guests because I was cooking all these meals and people would come in and help me. And then Kriyananda went to New York for some program, and a few of us went with him, and we were going to stay at this apartment of this couple. And I said, oh, yes, I know them because they used to work with me back in the kitchen there. So we came in, and he introduced me by my Sanskrit name, and I said, I know you because we used to work in the kitchen. Oh, no, we've never met you before. I said, no, I know. Remember, we were there, we did this, we worked together. No, that was a different girl, he said. And they said it to me 3 times before I had the brains to just say, yes, it was a different girl. Because what they were saying to me is, you've changed. You know, I remember that girl. You know, she had these little glasses, and she was really, really tight. And I just wasn't that person anymore. And so they just refused to accept that I was the same person. And finally, I thought Divine Mother was playing with me, and I just decided to enthusiastically affirm that, of course, that was somebody else. I must have been mistaken. And I just loved it, you know, because it had crept up. I didn't know where I had changed because I was the bulb the whole way. You know, it was a step-by-step thing for me. Shall we take a short break and then have a few minutes at the end? Okay, let's take another short break. Do you have any questions? Yes, Jeffrey?
I'm awful as the question answered, but
you
what about hate?
Oh, what about hate?
I mean, in a kind of more intellectual, theological sense, love and hate, isn't it kind of one and the same, you know?
Well, in this sense, which is both are a strong... Well, no, that's not true. Let me phrase it differently. Love and hate are not opposite. Because love is an eternal reality and hate is a temporary confusion. But where hate and love are opposites to each other is when we say, I can't be happy unless I have this certain thing. Or I can never be happy if this is in my life. You know, hatred is saying it has to be out of my life or I won't be happy. And what some people call love is saying, I have to have this or I won't be happy. But it's really just likes and dislikes. And allowing our happiness to be defined by something other than the fact that bliss is our own nature. So we have to learn to love. And see, in English, we have to keep using the same word. But what we have to learn is we have to love the divine in everything and then behave appropriately. See, so you can love something and also drive it out of your life. But you love the essence of the spirit within it. You know that even this deeply deluded, extremely negative and dangerous person still has the divine spirit within them, but I'm just not going to have that rest of it here. So you don't hate them, but you know that it's that you push that force away from your field because that's what has to happen. That's why I was saying you don't have to just accept everything. But what you have to strive to overcome is you need to move your sense of dependency from the circumstances of your life to your own inner consciousness. And so that's why hating is not good, because that's saying I can't. And that's why making your habit conditional is not good. But loving is good, because even if you love in a limited way, it's a stepping stone.
Reality, do I love that person? No, I love what's happening to me when I'm getting from that person. Not love, it's something else. Something
very
unloving.
Kriyananda made a remark, and he said it sort of tongue-in-cheek, knowing what he was saying. He says, I don't know, he said, there's something, I guess I'm just, there's something wrong with me. He said, the way I feel about other people has never been affected by how they feel about me. He said, or how they treat me. He says, you know, if I am loyal to someone, I'm just loyal to them, through thick and thin. Yogananda put it more in a bigger, different context, he said, you know, a mother is so attached to her child, and then if that baby dies, she mourns so much. But if that same soul is born next door to the woman next door, she doesn't love that child in the same way. He says, what did she love? She loved what she possessed. She didn't really love the essence of that person. And he said only, and then he talked about, this is in the context of talking about how the masters love us and how God loves us. They love us unconditionally in all circumstances. Whereas, Yogananda put it, he said, much of what people call love is merely convenience. Or he says, I love you as long as you please me. And when you cease to please me, I cease to love you. Now, it may be that when you behave a certain way, I no longer want to be near you because it's not appropriate anymore to be near you. I often say to people, it's easy to love, and this is more in practical relationships classes, it's easy to love people. The trick is to make a life together. You can love many people. Loving is not hard. Making a life together, now that's a real challenge. And so people sometimes get confused between loving someone and making a life with them, or they what they call love is just really love without challenge. You know, I remember a woman said to me, forgive me if I'm offending some of you, but she said, oh, I love the beginnings of relationships. And I heard her say that, and I said, but that implies that you'll have many, many beginnings. Do you really want to have many, many beginnings? Because that means you're going to have many, many endings. Is that really what you're looking for? But she wasn't really talking about love. She was just talking about, I don't know what she was talking about. Romance. She was talking about herself. If you love someone, you love them more and more. You don't just like them for a little bit until they become inconvenient. You know, but it's a much more challenging level. But what you're saying also about what you really love is what's happening to you is absolutely true of every single life experience. Because all you ever experience is your own inner consciousness. And if you're in a bad mood, the most beautiful things do not make you happy. And if you're in a good mood, even the most difficult things do not take away your happiness. It's all from inside of you. You respond to circumstances according to your predisposition. That's why you need to work on your willpower and your ability to be in charge of your predisposition and not think I have to have circumstances. Of course, it's too much to ask. You can't do it all at once. That's why you do it one inch at a time. And that's what leads to, you know, extreme spiritual practices of, going barefoot in the snow and only eating nettles and even flagellating yourself. You do things that are completely opposite to your own inclinations in order to master those inclinations so that you become in charge of your own happiness. Most of us, God is not asking us to do those sorts of things, but the extreme makes the point. You know, so what if I came home and I wanted her to have dinner on the table and she knew that I really wanted it, but she didn't? So what if she continues to use those sheets and I don't really like those sheets on the bed, or if she bought that piece of furniture and I really didn't like that piece of furniture? I mean, yes, but what is it? You may need to express yourself, but afterwards, so what? What does it matter? My happiness isn't dependent on their obeying me. I went through a period of time where I realized, I was getting so mad at David about various things. And I finally just realized in my own head, where in the contract did it say that he was supposed to behave in a certain way so that I would be happy? Like, his behavior's not really so outrageous. It just sort of is a little different than what I prefer. And I thought, I said to myself, how did I ever start down this road where every time he diverges a quarter inch from my little model of who he's supposed to be, I'm having a temper tantrum? And I thought I took myself down this road, and I just really took a lot of willpower. I just backed myself up. And every time I started just feeling outraged because, he dared to do something other than what my little plan for him was, I thought, wait a minute. It's I who am so screwed up because I've got my happiness so dependent on every little breath he takes. And I love him very deeply, more so, since I broke that habit, which I didn't break completely, but I certainly backed up enough to save my marriage, which was useful, It's like, he's not here to make me happy. I started thinking he was there to make me happy. And then I would measure every day whether he was doing it or not.
Tough my life.
Yeah, well, I will. I mean, but it's a tough one. It's a tough one for all of us, or the people in your store are there to make you happy, or my body's there to make me happy, or my money's there to make me happy, or my home is there to make me happy. It's mostly men and women. It's the big one, giant one. Yeah, you're right. I mean, without singling out your wife, but we just do think this, and we just get start down this road. He's not making me happy. He was really there to make me happy. And generally, he's just, I mean, David said to me once, oh, this was so awful. It was so true. He said, everything is fine, and then you get upset. Okay, now my first response to that was the obvious one. Well, it damn well wasn't fine. That's why I'm getting upset. You know, that was my first response. But David is like, he talks like one-tenth as much as I talk. And when he speaks, he actually means what he says, and he doesn't say it till he really knows what he means, unlike me. I test it all out. You know? I try it out, and then I find the one that I like way down the line after everyone stopped listening. And but he just said that. And then, you know, I was spluttering, but this was during my trying to not be so unpleasant period. And after I stopped spluttering, I started really thinking about it. And a very interesting meaning came out of it, which was true, which was he was more or less just going along as he is, you know, just being himself. And then he would do something that I would suddenly attach an enormous amount of meaning to. And there just wasn't that much meaning in it. Yes, it might have been nicer if he were me and communicated with me exactly the way I want to communicate. Maybe even it would be, you know, terrific for him if he could learn this lesson. But the amount of energy I was putting into his attitudes was way out of proportion to his. And by doing that, everything was fine, and then I got upset. You see how suddenly I just saw it from his point of view? That he's just going in, coming home from work, commenting about something, and all of a sudden I'm off, you know, on the moon. And he's just looking at me like, you know, what is wrong with you, woman? You know, what is wrong with you? And I was looking at him like, you know, don't you know this? Don't you know that kind of stuff? And then I had to just really say he's absolutely right. And if I just let things go on without getting upset, things would actually be fine. Do you see what I mean? Now, I'm not talking about, you know, gigantic, real life conflicts, which sometimes you have gigantic real life conflicts. I'm talking about the kind of everyday disagreements that destroy relationships. Because it's pretty much that everyday ugliness that gradually takes the joy out of it. And I just decided that everything was fine if I just didn't get upset. And you know what? It was true. If I just let that little thing that I was grabbing go by, in another minute, his energy would be different. Do you see what I mean? Whereas if I grabbed it, then it drove him and I, it drove both of us into a place we didn't want to go. Do you see what I mean? It was an incredibly powerful lesson. Of course, I'm talking to the man, and that tends to be a syndrome of women, but I'm also talking to the women. But it's most manifest in an intimate relationship, but it's true everywhere. A great deal of the time, nothing has really happened until you react to it. You see, something very small has happened that could easily be handled, but once you react to it, it becomes a big thing to handle.
Well, I think, Marcia, the thing to do is, number one, is sincerely pray constantly. The second thing is develop a mantra, develop an affirmation, you know, that as soon as you recognize that you're caught, even if you've already blown up, you can start saying whatever it might be. You know, scientific healing affirmations has lots of them. Swami's book has lots of them. One that's really apropos, that just says, you know, nothing and no one can harm me, or I am what I am before my conscience and God. The opinion of men mean nothing to me. God loves me just the way I am. What matter what happens in this world? I mean, whatever it is that you can really say over and over a lot. That's number one. The second thing is when somebody meditate on the fact afterwards is the only way you can do it for a while. But just try to really try to feel what they intended rather than what I felt. I just really got it from David's point of view. You know, people do so many things that do not have conscious intention behind them. They're just random words. It's the way they were raised. It's the vocabulary they have. It's things that just do not have that kind of intention. So just concentrate on trying to feel it from another person's point of view and practice in other circumstances. When people talk to you, instead of just hearing what they say, try to really just put yourself into their consciousness and really think about who this person is who's talking to me. And it's a real good thing for being critical too, like, why? What kind of a mindset? I play with this when I see people walk. I look at the clothes that they wear. I like to look at human nature, and I think, now what would be the steps that would cause that to happen? Why would a person have a posture like this? Why would they choose those particular colors? And critical or not critical, I try to feel what it feels like to be them. And then all of a sudden, gosh, the whole world looks really different from that point of view. What motivates them? And practice that a lot. Because what you're really doing is you're not feeling their reality or feeling your own. So practice feeling other people's realities at times when it's not pushing your buttons. You know, just make it an exercise. Because people are so different. It's just really fascinatingly fun how different they are. Different cultures, and in this area it's so rich, you know. You go to the Walmart, which I've been visiting lately, and oh my, it's just a little United Nations. You know, and you just, all these people, and I try to use my sensitivity in the positive way to feel their consciousness and then watch how they treat each other and talk to each other and then feel like it's from their point of view. If you practice that a lot, you'll find you'll be much less inclined, it'll become more of a habit to think about it. But the answer is the same as Jeff's. How do you make progress over things that are, you know, that are cellular? Slowly. That's all you can say, it's just slowly. You know, it is. It's in your DNA. I recently was visiting my parents, and just like, you know, I'm 52 years old now. Bingo, I just saw a life pattern. You know, just, oh my God. I thought this was normal, and this is really just the way I was trained as a child. I just went, you know, like my breath stopped. It was just unbelievable. So we're fighting against a lot. Be kind to yourself. And when, where you can, don't worry about what you're... You know what Swami said to me once?
What?
I was talking about a certain person that I had trouble getting along with. He had a wonderful answer. He said, when I'm with them, I just don't have a personality, is what he said. He said, because if I don't have a personality, I get along with them perfectly. And he said, why do I have to have a personality? Why can't they just have all the personality in the room? And I loved that. And I've been using that a great deal lately because, see, I'm really pushy. And so when I meet people who push back, I feel like they're pushing on me. And they're not. It's just that I am a pushy person. So I say to myself, why do I have to have a personality? Why not just let them have the whole personality? So they're controlling, so they always want to be this and that. What's it to me? It only matters because it interferes with my ability to be controlling and pushy. And so I just pretend, I play. What would it be like not to have a personality? And I just relax and have no personality. It's great fun. It's really, really fun, especially for someone as aggressive as me. Just have no personality. Then all of a sudden you have all this strange harmony. It's just their turn. Let them have their turn. It's always neutral. And then you see, of course, when you don't fight back, often things just work out fine. Now, I know you're going to ask me a bigger question, but that is really still the answer.
No, that's good. That's good. Well, I just have one little piece after that. And then what if you were, you know, in a position of responsibility? Somehow, we have responsibility to other people as well.
It can't be answered in the abstract. It's not an abstract question. It's a how do I win this person to this cause? You need to read Swami's leadership book. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's too late for that question because it's 1 o'clock. All right. Thank you all very much. This turned out to be fun. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
Okay.